From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Monday, December 4th, 2017. And on this day, 1st District Congresswoman Shelley Pingree says she may run for governor. And what Canada's New Deal with the EU could mean for lobstermen in Maine. That's all ahead in just a moment. Democratic Congresswoman Shelley Pingree is considering a run for governor. That would make a big difference in the already crowded Democratic Party primary field. Steve Missler has our story.
From her office in D.C., Pingree says the idea of a potential gubernatorial run is largely being driven by pressure from her supporters.
I love doing the work that I do. I feel honored to be in Congress. A lot of people have asked me to consider a gubernatorial run, so I said I would give it some serious thought. It would be wonderful to be in the state of Maine.
Pingree says it's important for Democrats to take control of the governor's office, to undo what she said is a lot of damage inflicted by its current occupant, Republican Governor Paul LePage. Pingree and the governor have repeatedly and publicly clashed over the past 7 years, so the idea of replacing LePage is an enticing one, both for Pingree and the progressive activists that adore her. Pingree and Democrats have been the majority party in the House for just 2 terms since she was first elected nearly a decade ago, and out of power for the last 4. Over that time, Pingree has built up seniority, earning a spot on the powerful Appropriations Committee. That's given her a voice in funding decisions that directly impact Maine. And right now, the progressive fight is acutely focused on the Republican-controlled Congress and President Trump, whose unpopularity in national opinion polls has Democrats hoping for a wave year in next year's congressional elections.
I feel like, you know, our job is more important than ever. There's a good chance the Democrats could be in control next year, and given a lot of the work that I really care about doing, that's a great choice.
Pingree was first elected to Congress in 2008, defeating a large Democratic primary field and Republican Charlie Summers in the general election. Since then, she has easily defeated GOP challengers to hold the more liberal 1st congressional district. But her gubernatorial bid, if it happens, will spur widespread speculation about her viability as a statewide candidate. While the state's more rural 2nd congressional district has elected Democrats before, it has recently swung right, electing Republican Congressman Bruce Poliquin twice, decisively backing LePage, and picking Trump last year. Pingree lost her first statewide race in 2002 when she attempted to defeat Republican Senator Susan Collins. Collins won that contest by nearly 17 percentage points. How much of those factors will influence Pingree's decision is unclear, and so is the ratio of supporter pressure to personal ambition playing into her decision to run for governor or stay in Congress.
A person can only run for governor if the fire's in their belly, if it's exactly where they want to be, and they think it's the right choice at the right time. If this was 10 years ago before I ran for Congress, I would have absolutely wanted to be the governor. It's a great job.
11 Democrats are already in the race, but several could drop out or try to run for Pingree's seat if she runs for governor. She says she'll make her decision by the end of the month. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Steve Missler.
Governor Paul LePage says he's waiting to see if the investigation by Oxford County commissioners into allegations against Sheriff Wayne Gallant yields a complaint to his office before he decides what action to take. Matt Leary has details.
Sheriff Gallant has admitted to sending a lewd photo while in uniform in his office to a woman 2 years ago, but has denied allegations of seeking sex with employees. Governor LePage says he's waiting to see if he receives a formal complaint about Gallant before deciding whether to hold a hearing on Gallant's possible removal from office.
I don't know enough about it. If the allegations are true, then yeah, he should resign.
Under the state constitution, only the governor can remove a sheriff from office after receiving a complaint and holding a hearing. Oxford County commissioners have a closed meeting planned for Tuesday evening for a briefing from the county's lawyer, Brian Dench. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Mal Leary.
This state has one of the highest rates of veteran suicide in the nation, according to a recent study by the Department of Veterans Affairs. Advocates in Maine say it is time to confront the issue and shine a light on it. This story from Abukar Adan.
Veterans in the U.S. are more than twice as likely as civilians to take their own lives. Here in Maine, that rate is even higher.
I don't know a single veteran who doesn't know someone who hasn't committed suicide. And we just don't talk about it that way.
Adria Horn, who heads the Maine Bureau of Veteran Services, says she has her own stories to tell.
My group sergeant major, when I was a major in PSYOP, committed suicide at Fort Bragg. One of my soldiers, after being deployed and redeploying from Iraq, committed suicide. I mean, I can tell you this is personal. Other people need to assume that it is personal and it is happening instead of assuming that it hasn't happened and you can't be part of the solution.
In September, the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs released its most comprehensive analysis of veteran suicide in each state and region, and it found that in 2014, Maine outpaced both the Northeast and the nation in veteran suicides. Maine's overall suicide rate was just under 20 per 100,000 people, but that number more than doubled for veterans, to 48 per 100,000. And Linda LaJoy believes that number may even be higher.
And nobody's talking about it. We're brushing it under the rug.
LaJoy has been committed to raising awareness about suicide since her 26-year-old son, Dustin, a veteran of the war in Afghanistan, took his own life in December of 2014. LaJoy recently started the Silhouette Project, a display of 22 life-size silhouette cutouts of soldiers, which represent the number of veterans who take their own lives each day in the U.S. LaJoy says she initially got some pushback from critics who feared that memorializing veterans who committed suicide would send the wrong message. But LaJoy insists that's not the point of her work.
I'm not trying to make them out as heroes for how they died. I'm trying to make them out as heroes for how they lived. You know, and the invisible fights they fought that we were never aware of.
That invisible fight is one that Seth Palmer, a Marine veteran who recently returned from deployment, is all too familiar with.
Rumble, can you sit? Hey.
Good boy, Rumble.
I still kind of get sketched out by large crowds. To me, there's such an unknown possibility that could happen. Driving, if I feel like someone's tailgating, like following me, if they turn two times the same direction I'm going, I'm taking a different way home at that point.
Being constantly on guard, Palmer says, can be draining. But unlike some veterans, he has a strong web of support in his life. Even so, reaching out wasn't exactly easy for him at first.
I felt like I was being judged if I had gone seeked help. I felt like people were going to think I was weak. I was a leader. I couldn't be weak. I couldn't seem weak. I couldn't receive help on my own.
That's why it's important, advocates say, to be proactive.
Ask someone if they are feeling suicidal. Just ask them, are you okay?
Adria Horn of the Maine Bureau of Veteran Services.
All too often we have daily conversations that are mundane and about, you know, getting the car serviced and paying the bills and not actual general life conversations. I just want to take a break and say, are you okay?
Horn's office is hosting the first annual Military Veteran Symposium, which will focus on suicide prevention. It's scheduled for December 12th at the University of Southern Maine in Portland and is open to the public. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Abukar Adan.
Finally today, as the Trump administration reassesses its international trade policies, the Canadian government is moving forward with a new European trade agreement that'll give its lobster suppliers an 8% price advantage in EU countries. Maine lobster dealers hope to capitalize on longstanding relationships with buyers in Asia and Europe to offset that competitive disadvantage. But at least one major lobster shipper says lower prices for EU customers could encourage the industry to develop new markets here at home. AJ Higgins has more.
Inside Reddy's Seafood on the Portland waterfront, the atmosphere is akin to a Wall Street trading pit. Sellers occupy a bank of telephones that connect them to buyers in Europe and China, hoping to close lobster shipments in time for Christmas and New Year's celebrations. Being able to communicate in more than one language is a distinct advantage for ready seller Daniel Speranza, who holds dual citizenship in the U.S. and Italy.
In Italy, they love lobsters, especially our main lobsters. They prefer ours over any of the other ones, being much sweeter in flavor and the meat texture is much better.
But lately, Speranza says his European buyers are spending more time talking prices. That's because of the new Canadian Comprehensive Economic and Trade Agreement with European Union countries that gives Canadian lobster shippers an 8% advantage over their main competitors.
I receive phone calls every day about this. People would like to, they want to save that 8%. It's a big, big chunk of money for them. A lot of them tell me that that's basically their profit over there. And they're basically telling us, I won't be able to buy from you all year because we have to buy from Canada in order to save the 8%.
Moving Maine lobsters from Stonington to Shanghai or Paris is no easy task. At Reddy's, aerated tanks can hold up to 300,000 pounds of lobsters until they can be boxed and shipped to their international destinations. Owner Brendan Reddy says that historically, Canadian dealers already had a price advantage over Maine because of the exchange rate. But he says the dynamics of the lobster business still required Canada and Maine to cooperate on both lobster imports and exports. Now, he says, the new CETA agreement is changing those rules of engagement.
And that's kind of taken a Canadian trade partner, who is the United States' largest trade partner for live lobsters, and it's turned them more into kind of, I would say, a competitor over that time frame. And when you're competing, you're always looking for a strategic advantage, and I think the CETA agreement is a significant trade advantage that Canada has on Maine lobster dealers and shippers.
Some lobster dealers hope that increased domestic sales and a growing appetite for Maine lobster in China can help erase some of the sting from the lost EU sales. And even though Reddy doesn't expect to feel the full impact of that CETA deal until next year, he says some shippers are already preparing. And part of that could mean cutting prices.
Absolutely. No question about that whatsoever.
The movement of boxed lobsters being loaded onto trucks for air freight is one of the happier holiday sounds for Annie Salikas. The executive director of the Maine Lobster Dealers Association says there will definitely be an impact on Maine's 320 lobster dealers, who were responsible for about 80% of the U.S. lobster sales to the EU last year, totaling nearly $157 million. In addition to the 8% advantage that Canadians will have on live lobster sales to the EU, Salika says they will get an even larger advantage on the sales of processed lobster meat in the future.
It will eventually be phased in an elimination of a 20% tariff on processed lobster or other frozen and prepared lobster products, which currently enters at a 16% duty from the United States.
All of these numbers prompt Matt Jacobson of the Maine Lobster Collaborative to one conclusion.
There are risks inherent in international trade, and I don't think any business that's in that line would tell you any differently.
Jacobson says that one of the easiest ways to confront the disadvantages posed to Maine lobster dealers by foreign markets is to focus on sales at home. He says enhanced processing techniques and quicker shipping turnarounds can deliver high-quality frozen and live products for American consumption. In fact, Jacobson says if just one out of three Americans ate a lobster each year, they would consume Maine's entire annual catch. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm A.J. Higgins.
For more of today's Maine news, visit our website, mainepublic.org. And from Maine Public, that's This Day in Maine for Monday, December 4th, 2017. Thanks to Ed Morin and our digital team, I'm Nora Flaherty.